Hello, welcome to By Design. I'm Fenella Kernebone. Great to have your company here on RN. Coming up today, the future is here and how HODL shaped Melbourne. Well, coming up today on By Design, we ask why we're in the middle of a new industrial revolution, a transformation of the way that we design, make and use objects. Why training in design and design thinking can be a fantastic backbone to an entrepreneurial life. And how did Melbourne get its grid? And what was there before Robert HODL surveyed the land?
At first it was essentially an illegal settlement. So when HODL surveyed the grid and the land was laid out, they had to vacate the land or buy the site they're on. But the centre of the town remained in the same place, the cluster of buildings remained in the same place. And next to the Yarra was low flooding land, and there was a sort of cliff or escarpment set back from it, and we're actually on that now. The Rialto building in which we are is on this cliff.
And you'll hear more from him, architectural historian Miles Lewis, with the story of surveyor Robert HODL a bit later here on By Design. Now, if there's one thing that we've talked about at various times on this show is the fact that we really are in an age of transformation. The boundaries between the consumer, manufacturer and designer are increasingly being blurred. So instead of buying that new part you need to replace that missing bit of the remote control, you could 3D print it instead at home. Or you could even design your own home using open source software. And the possibilities for healthcare are more than exciting. I caught up with Alex Newsom from London's Design Museum, the curator of the touring exhibition The Future Is Here, which has just opened in Melbourne this week at the Design Hub, part of RMIT, and includes many Australian innovations and technologies, to hear how the future is, in fact, here.
We are in a moment, I suppose, at the moment, we have been for a few years, where there is a potentially a significant change in the production of our physical goods. There's a shift from the previous way of industrial production that's been around for decades, hundreds of years, that kind of requires us essentially to make hundreds of thousands of copies of identical objects in order for it to be cost effective. And we rely on that. We rely on that to kind of make cheap objects that we need, that we want, that we use. And it's led to the creation of things like the city as we know it and kind of everything that that brings with it, like commuting and all of the things that kind of the industrial revolutions kind of brought. So the exhibition's a proposition about, well, what if there's another way of doing things, what could that mean for us?
But you needed to start, I imagine, this conversation about the third industrial revolution at a particular place to sort of demonstrate to us where things have changed and where things have come from. So how did you do that?
Yeah, well, if you talk about the concept of a new industrial revolution, you have to then say, well, what is an industrial revolution? What was the original industrial revolution? So I suppose we did discuss the fact that there was a small period of change between the 18th and 19th centuries where there was steam power, kind of industrialised pottery manufacturing, and these huge number of kind of innovations that happened very quickly that changed the world. And then quite soon afterwards, it's what people loosely term the Second Industrial Revolution, when the Model T Ford was around, and actually kind of factory belt production in a way, and that mechanized production that again changed the way things are produced, that essentially paved the groundworks to kind of modern mass production. And then that leads us to decades where that kind of model of making was taking place, and now we're trying to shake it up and change it again and disrupt that.
Let's talk about what has actually been disrupted and in what way. What's sort of a great example just to begin with to sort of set the tone?
So one good example of the disruption is customized goods. The idea that actually to customize something is quite luxurious. Previously, you'd have to have something that's made by an artisan craftsperson. That's incredibly expensive. You're needing their skill, their talent, their time to produce it. But actually, if you can use digital tools and digital craft to actually make something customized and kind of iron out those long-winded, expensive processes, then you can make customized goods available to people on the high street.
So you're killing luxury, that's the idea.
It's disrupting luxury, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, and the idea, of course, is that the democratization of this process is becoming more and more evident.
And I mean, goods can work better. They can be more bespoke for us. Something can work better if it fits to the kind of physical properties of your own body. Mm. Might mean that you can't share it quite so much with someone else who doesn't have the same physical properties. But you can make objects, like designers call them, about making fitter objects, making them that perform better for us.
What about the big manufacturers like Adidas or like Nike or anything like that? I mean, the idea of being able to have your own shoe custom made is pretty pretty attractive, particularly if you're a runner or a jogger or something like that. But how fast are they catching up, and what are the challenges that they're faced with?
They're kind of being, they want to be involved in the realm of digital production, but they're kind of also being forced to because their customers, the consumers, are demanding it. They realise that things can be customised, can be digitally produced, and they say, hey, we want some of this. So the big kind of manufacturers are involved. You can customise your shoes. I mean, I was a bit sceptical when I first looked at it, and so I said to Adidas here in the exhibition, well, can you send me every single component and every single colourway that is customisable? And this enormous box of components arrived at my desk, and I was sifting through them. I was like, actually, yeah, this is a considerable amount. Mm. I mean, there aren't necessarily digital processes in the production of those shoes, but there are in the networks and the interface and the software that allows you to customise it online. I think that's where the digital side comes in.
On By Design, my guest is Alex Newson, who is the curator of The Future Is Here, which is a London Design exhibition, well, from the London Design Museum. Of course, has travelled to Australia and is now open at RMIT. You mentioned before that's what the customers want. And that's kind of the key, isn't it? It's about how we as consumers are facing ourselves up against the manufacturing process. We're actually calling for it, I suppose. This decision-making suddenly becomes ours as opposed to somebody else's.
Yeah, it empowers the customer. I mean, the big Karl Marx thing was that he believed that kind of political power was controlled by those who have the means of production. Well, what if we have the means of production? What happens to the kind of the power base there, the traditional power bases of manufacturing? And that's quite an exciting thing to actually think about. In theory, it works really well. Actually, in practice, there's a barrier of access, not just to actually the making, but the barrier of access to the imagination of what to make. And I think that's still the really kind of tricky thing for us to get over and actually work out. Kind of, well, if we have power to use these technologies, if we bought a 3D printer, we took it home, which you can do, what are we going to use it to make? I mean, I'm not quite sure what I'd use it for yet, and I think that's
a bowl.
Well, exactly. There are quite, I mean, one of the things that's always been explained to me is, well, what if you lose the back of your TV remote control and you sort of tape it up, or the tape falls out and the batteries fall out, you go out and buy a whole new remote control. Actually, you can just print out the new back and clip it in. So there are these little things that are useful, and at the moment I think it's more to do with kind of almost high-tech make do and mend, and actually fixing up the current things you've got rather than actually creating new goods. But that'll change and that'll evolve.
We're only really talking about 3D printing, which has been around for about 10 years or so. So what stage are we at here? Is there something bigger than this?
For the technologies to be generally formative and actually change things, it's not one technology working on its own. None of the previous industrial revolutions have ever been about a singular technology operating in isolation. It's about one impacting on another and two or three working kind of in companion. And actually then the networks and the social communities that actually thrive and join all these things together. So 3D printing is one of the ones that everyone wants to talk about because it's fashionable and it's quite exciting. But actually things like CNC, which is computer numerical control, which it was developed in the 50s or the 60s. I think it was researchers at MIT first plugged a machine tool into a computer and found that they could actually control the machine tool through the computer. That's probably the one that's used the most. It's mature technology, so it's been around for a while. It works, it doesn't kind of fail, and people really understand how to use it now. But they're still finding new and innovative uses for it. So it's all of these different technologies working together that really create new innovations, I think.
Yeah. What's a new and innovative way of using CNC? Give me a new one in the exhibition.
Actually, there's a company called Unto This Last who make and design furniture, who use fairly old CNC techniques, but they've developed parametric software that automatically changes their design files according to what the customers want. So you can have bespoke customized chairs and benches of certain sizes with different material finishes, and the software will automatically change the design files according to what the customers want and the type of material they're putting into the machine. So again, that's disrupting luxury. It's giving what would have previously taken an artisan craftsperson to make, and it's letting them use digital tools to create digital craft in a way.
Have you had a chance to play around with this equipment yourself?
Yeah, I have. I'm not the best at it. I haven't had the chance to use it as much as I would like. Some of the things are more easy to use than others. I mean, I think one of the difficult things is the leap between 2D and 3D. To conceive designing objects in three dimensions is a very different thing than doing it in two dimensions. Mm. We had a number of our front of house staff when we had the show in London. We asked to use the equipment in the gallery and to make objects and to talk to the visitors about what it is that they're making. I think the hardest leap they found was to actually understand what it goes from making something in 2D and cutting it on the laser cutter or CNC machine and just having a 2D shape, and then actually designing something to be three dimensionals and printing it out is a big conceptual leap.
Okay, so this is forcing us to be really engaged in the design process.
Yeah, as much as you want. I mean, you don't have to fully engage with it. You can dip your toe in it. And that's, I think that's part of it. You don't really need to be kind of an expert designer. You can just get involved as much as you like.
When I'm listening to this, I mean, it's an obvious question, I suppose, but the idea that I can design and make and print, and I become the designer, I become the creator, I suppose. I am the maker. No longer is there someone else making it for me. So am I? What happens to our designers?
Well, we often talk about this holy trinity of stakeholders in design. There's the designer, there's the manufacturer, and then there's the consumer, the user. And they're kind of traditionally, they're three separate entities. But these technologies dissolve those boundaries. Actually, one person, as you say, can be all three of those. So, I mean, one of the questions that I asked designers when I first started doing my research was, well, what's the point in you anymore? Is the designer, as a professional, becoming obsolete with these technologies? And, I mean, obviously they all said no, and actually all gave quite clear kind of arguments for why that's the case. I mean, one of the projects is by Esser Asawach, who he talks about co-designing with consumers, and actually uses examples of products that if you let a customer completely design it, you change the utility of the product and you make it no longer usable potentially. So he uses things like lemon squeezers that can be 3D printed, and he asks customers or consumers to co-design them with him, but he locks certain areas down so that they can't change them and can't ruin the utility of the objects and his original design.
Great to have a conversation with you. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And that is Alex Newson there, who is from London's Design Museum. I was speaking to him on site at the Design Hub at RMIT in Melbourne, all about the exhibition called The Future Is Here. And while that exhibition did start in London, it also incorporates Australian innovation.
This exhibition allows us to kind of insert a number of projects at various points. Some of them are quite well resolved, well finished, in fact, are turned out now into products that you can buy off the shelf. Others at a very speculative stage. One is a quick time bone replacement parts. You have a cancer in your bone, for example. That cancer is scanned and it's replaced with a titanium part that has a lattice insert, so that then that component is the weight and density of the bone that's been taken out, so you're recovering much more quickly. The future of this is that there's 3D printers in the surgery.
Kate Rhodes there, who is the co-curator of The Future Is Here, which is on at RMIT at the Design Hub, and you can find some links on our website.
You're listening to By Design. Find us online at abc.net.au/rn/bydesign.
Indeed you are. Now, coming up soon, how an architect designing a building got a great idea for a new business, and also what was Melbourne like before Robert Hoddle got his hands on it, surveying in 1837, I believe it was. And later this hour, RN First Bite, Michael McKenzie is on your radio. Michael, hello.
G'day, Fanelli. Yes, I think Melbourne before Hoddle came along was just made of gaffer tape.
It was. Yes, yep. Exactly. Yep. Very sticky indeed. Now, you have a really interesting sort of conversation today about the role of bananas and vitamin A. Tell me more.
Yeah, that's right, because in some ways what we're doing is continuing the theme of design, in this case designing food to literally save lives. And there's a great deal of contentious debate that stretches back 30 years in the cases of some foods like rice as to whether it's allowable for us to genetically modify a food so that it literally stops people having vitamin A or iron deficiencies, which mean in turn that up to 2 million people don't lose their lives in the developing world. We'll be doing a whole half hour on this incredibly, well, vital, but also contentious
really,
issue.
Certainly is. RN First Bite with Michael McKenzie on your radio very soon, right here on RN. Thanks, Michael.
Cheers.
But this is By Design. Now it's time to head to Melbourne. In 1837, a surveyor named Robert Hoddle was sent from Sydney to the mouth of the Yarra, and he was charged with the duties of laying out what would become the city of Melbourne. The design was a cross-thatched layout running parallel to the river, and it has now become known as Hoddle's Grid. Reporter Matt Smith is with architectural historian Miles Lewis, overlooking the Hoddle Grid and discussing how it has shaped and defined today's Melbourne.
Swanson Street, now a major street, was named after Captain Swanson, who was one of the members of Batman's association that bought land here. Today we don't think he's very important, it's just chances that he was a member of that group. Queen Street, we assume, was named after, well, Queen Victoria's about to come to the throne, it's very hard to know exactly what some of these streets were named after. And looking down, we see the bridge across just where the Falls Bridge used to be. There's a reef across the Yarra which stopped the seawater coming up, and so the shipping could only get that far, and that was the cause of the foundation of Melbourne at this point. The old Customs House, which is now the Immigration Museum, is on the site where everybody landed at Melbourne. So when they came to survey the grid, it began from roughly this point we're looking down on now.
So when they came to make the grid that Melbourne city layout is based on. What was here when they came here? Was there any kind of design to the colony as it started?
No, at first it was essentially an illegal settlement, so the buildings here, they had no rights. So when Hoddle surveyed the grid and the land was laid out, they had to vacate the land or buy the site they're on. In fact, in every case, virtually, they vacated the land. So none of the buildings that were there survived Hoddle's survey. But the centre of the town remained in the same place, the cluster of buildings remained in the same place, and next to the Yarra was low, flooding land, and there was a sort of cliff or escarpment set back from it, and we're actually on that now. The Rialto building in which we are is on this cliff, and all the buildings were kept north of that cliff. If you picture coming up the Yarra, if you're John Pascoe Fortune or John Batman, you can't go any further up because of the reef. Above the reef there's fresh water, which is essential for settlement, so it's another reason for stopping and making this the heart of the settlement. When the surveyors come, when Robert Hoddle comes with Governor Burke, he adopts this site. He sets the grid out not north, south, east, west, as you might expect, but he sets it out more or less parallel with the river, which was a convenient thing to do. But otherwise, the assumption always was that you'd survey in a rectangular fashion. People often speak about the surveyors being unimaginative, but it's just the logical way to do it. So you adjust the direction of the grid to suit the topography, but the form of the grid is rectangular.
So what was the thinking in doing it that way? Why not have it more of an organic land use like Sydney is, I suppose?
The surveyors all really aspired to rectangular grid. Sydney differs only because it was founded before these regulations became firm. Ironically, if you have a settlement founded by the government, as Sydney and Hobart, where nobody has any rights to the land, it becomes less regular, because if you're the overseer of convicts or the chief of the Marines, something of this sort, and the governor gives you permission to build, you don't worry about the boundaries or the land tenure. So Sydney was a mess before any freehold land was sold, and so was Hobart. Whereas Melbourne, anybody buying land had to be sure of their boundaries, had to conform to the government regulations, therefore we were much more regular. And in fact, one of the conditions of the first sale was you had to build a substantial brick building on the site. So unlike earlier Australian settlements, once the land was sold, suddenly substantial buildings began to grow up. Melbourne grew up like a sort of instantaneous city as a result.
If you could explain the structure of the grid then, what was the planning behind the dimensions, say, of the streets and the blocks?
Well, under Governor Darling in 1829, regulations had been drawn up covering the whole of New South Wales, and Melbourne was at that time part of New South Wales. So all surveys from that time had 10 chain square blocks, and a chain is almost exactly 20 metres, and that divided into 20 half-acre allotments, and a half-acre is, what, about 0.4 of a hectare, something like that. So the only reason Sydney and Hobart and so on are not like that is that they were surveyed first, so we are really part of the general New South Wales practice. The difference here was that those regulations had been done under Governor Darling. He left, and with a new governor, Governor Burke, who had different ideas, and he wanted to have small streets. So Melbourne has the lanes, Flinders Lane, Little Collins Street and so on, which are not part of the New South Wales conception, which were put in at Governor Burke's insistence.
Now, they were to service the backs of buildings, and if I remember correctly, are those half a chain in length?
Yes. The idea was they'd service the backs, but because land was short and Melbourne boomed, very soon major buildings were being built on those streets, so they didn't function as they'd been intended. And what's interesting is that after Governor Burke had left and Hoddle remained surveying, he gradually changed the survey practice to get rid of those lanes. So in East Melbourne, the lanes were widened out to become streets. So there's no longer a sense of the being lanes. He just, stage by stage, typical way a public servant resists instructions from above, actually turned the thing on its head.
I think we should be grateful to Governor Burke then, because the laneways in Melbourne are a great little feature of the landscape, I find.
Yes, and there's nothing quite like that in Sydney, so it is an advantage. Now, the other thing to say about this is, this is not unique planning. It's very like planning in the United States. Everything is rectangular there. And that's why, visiting Melbourne, it looks very like Chicago, a little brother of Chicago. When we grew up, it'll be like Chicago.
When they put the grid down, was it a good design for the area? And did it account for topography in the area? Did it work well in this place?
Well, the angle of the grid, as I say, it's not directly north, south, east, west, was designed to be parallel with the Yarra, and also it ran between Eastern Hill at one end and Batman's Hill the other, which is now almost destroyed, where the old Spencer Street station was. So it was quite a sensible layout in those terms, but it meant that when you go outside the centre of town, the ordinary suburban blocks were laid out in a essentially square north, south, east, west grid. So when you travel up Swanton Street, it suddenly bends. When you travel up Elizabeth Street, it's not clear because it goes a bit further up to the Haymarket. But you get this characteristic bend in the streets because of the way the central part is suited to the topography, and the surrounding land is just north, south, east, west for convenience.
What works better in your view?
Oh, well, for their own purposes, both work. I mean, for the city, you wanted to have the adjusting to the hills and the air. Outside it, it's convenient to have the land laid out in the simplest possible way.
Is it true that Elizabeth Street is built over a creek bed?
Yes, it was quite a hefty creek, and the lower parts of it were bridged and would flood, so people actually couldn't cross at Flinders Street or Collins Street in the early years. Very big flood, I think, in the 1950s when it overflowed and the whole Elizabeth Street was full and cars were washed away and so on.
In the time since then, how has the Hoddle grid held up? I mean, he couldn't have accounted for the building that we're standing in now and the balcony that we're standing on and these kind of dimensions.
It is virtually unchanged, the main grid. Of course, there have been additions to it, smaller streets, little lanes and so on. Many of those are put in to service the sewage, the night carts, to the sanitation, but it's worked very well. What hasn't worked often is the response of designers to the grid. The stronger the grid is, the harder it is to build, a public space, like the old city square on the corner of Collins and Swanson Street didn't work because you felt it was a corner site, not part of the design of the city. Even now, the town hall is on a corner site and doesn't work very well. To get a public building effective, you've got to have it sort of set back for a whole block length, so you feel it was designed, originally. And even private designers have not responded either, I think, very well in Melbourne to the constraints of the grid. By the 1850s, the proposals in Melbourne to actually buy back some of the land and sell it with conditions as to how you could build on it. If you think of London, where there are great squares in Belgravia and so on, with huge terraces, people thought Melbourne should be like that. You should have rows of terraces which are all designed as one and a degree of, you know, politeness and uniformity. The time has long gone long past for that.
So if we want to see something in the city now besides the grid layout that is part of their original intentions, what's left?
Well, I think some of the small lanes and spaces. The little laneway through near St Paul's Cathedral, through the Chapter House, you up steps and through that. The surrounds of the Supreme Court Library, where you go into the middle of a block and you have a sort of Dickensian area with gas lamps and things. The lanes which have become arcades, like the Block Arcade, are very interesting. So it's not the main hoddled streets that are interesting, it's the subsidiary spaces which have been inserted at later dates.
Sounds like you can have a pretty lovely wander through Melbourne. Architectural historian Miles Lewis there with reporter Matt Smith. And as always, links and images on our websites. And that is the show for today. Thanks to our producer, Jan Ryan, our sound engineer, Simon Branthwaite, and my name is Fenella. And do stay with us because Michael McKenzie joins you now with RN First Bite.